Good morning. The Public Safety and Violence Prevention Task Force hearing on today, August 25th, 2022, should come to order. Clerk, would you mind calling the roll? We do not need a quorum, but the roll should be called.
Sure thing. Ford?
Here.
Hurley?
Here.
Carroll? DeLuca? Flowers, Gonzalez, Hernandez, Hirschauer,
here,
LaPointe,
here,
Ma,
here,
Mayfield, Moylan, Yednock,
I am here,
Windhorst, Boss, Chesney, Ellick,
here,
McCombie, Stevens, Ugasti, Willauer. All right, that is 8 representatives present.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank everyone for coming. I'll just open up with the overview of what hate crimes are and how we deal with them in Illinois. So I'll go over the code. Under the Illinois Criminal Code, it is a hate crime for a person to commit certain offenses against another if the action was based on race, color, creed, religion, ancestry, citizenship, or immigration status, gender, sexual orientation, physical or mental disability, or national origin of another individual or group of individuals. The offenses are assault, battery, aggravated assault, intimidation, stalking, cyber stalking, misdemeanor, theft, criminal trespassing to a resident, misdemeanor, criminal damage to a property, criminal trespassing to a vehicle, criminal trespassing to real property, mob action, disorderly conduct, transmission of obscene messages, harassments by telephone, or harassments through electronic communication. For the record, the penalty is a Class 4 felony for the first offense and a Class 2 for subsequent offenses. However, if committed in certain designated areas, places of worship, school, parks, etc., then the first offense is a Class 3 felony with subsequent offenses being a Class 2. And I'm very happy that Representative Ma is on. Recently, changes to the code happened at her with her work. Senate Bill 1596, sponsored by Collins and Ma, which became Public Act 102-235, passed the House 116-00 on May 27, 2021, and it expanded the offenses to include if a crime is based on citizenship or immigration status, then it's a hate crime. Also, House Bill 3262, the work of West, Representative West and Senator Simmons, which became Public Act 120468, passed the House 113-00 on April 22nd, 2021, adding 3 forms of disorderly conduct to the types of conduct for which a person experiencing such as conduct as a result of hate crime may bring a civil action independent of any criminal prosecution. If asked, the 3 forms will be, so people will ask, well, I'll hold off on that, but there is a, I'll hold off and then we'll just go to the purpose of this hearing, and it is hate crimes in Illinois, the state and the national trends. And there were some questions asked before, And we'll hold off on it because this hearing was brought to you and to the people of Illinois because the chair, Hurley, and I were asked to hold it. This is the result of groups asking us to hold a hearing on hate crimes in Illinois. So thank you very much for being here today, and I'll turn it right over to Representative Hurley.
I just want to thank everybody for being here today and sharing your stories with us. So thank you.
Thank you. And before we go to members from the Democratic Party, Representative Amy, would you like to have an opening?
I'll echo the thanks to everybody for being here and providing the data that I know you'll provide and the information. I think it'll be eye-opening, and I look forward to hearing from everyone.
Thank you. And Representative Ma, I know that you have been working hard on these issues. Would you like to have an opening statement?
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to just say a few words and to attend this hearing. I think it's an important topic. And in particular, I just want to note that, you know, in the last 2.5 years during the pandemic, we've seen an increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans. And I hope that in the presentations, we're able to hear more about that. It's just a particularly concerning issue for me. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, the order will be as follows. We will have the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Then we will have the Center on Hosted, followed by Equality Illinois, followed by Anti-Hate Action Center, Chinese American Service League, followed by Anti-Hate Action Center. I think I said that. And then we will have the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago, followed by the Executive Director of Public Affairs of the Jewish United Fund, Jewish Federation of Chicago, the Midwest Region Director of Anti-Defam League, and then followed by the Illinois Department of Human Rights. And that will conclude our hearing today. So first up, Chicago Lawyers Committee, please step to the table and state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning.
Hold 1 second. There is a missed one here. There will be the Indian American Muslim Council will also be speaking. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning, co-chairs Ford and Hurley, and members of the task force. Thank you so much for your continued efforts to prevent all citizens of our diverse state from hate crime and violence, and to address this issue of hate crime further. My name is Julie Justice, and I am here representing Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. We're an organization that was formed in 1969 in the heart of our nation's civil rights movement that continues today to fight for racial equity in our city and throughout the state. For more than 30 years, our organization has had a hate crime program that has been focused on strengthening laws, providing information and outreach to communities affected by hate crime, and to addressing these issues both through supporting victims in criminal prosecutions and in initiating civil litigation to assist victims. We also, when appropriate, like to work with victims and offenders to engage in restorative justice practices when those are appropriate given the circumstances. All of these actions together, along with Illinois' robust and continually amended hate crime law, send a clear message that the state of Illinois rejects acts of bigotry and violence. like all of you, Chicago Lawyers Committee is concerned about increasing trends in hate crime, and as Representative Ma indicated, most recently against Asian American communities during the pandemic. And, you know, at various times through our nation's history, we see various communities targeted for hate. And one of the key things I'd like to address today is how do we get a sense of what the real numbers are? It's pretty clear that for a long time and continuing through today, hate crimes are significantly underreported. And what I'd like to do is maybe touch on why that is, and then my colleagues from different community partner organizations and Director Jim Bennett from IDHR are going to follow with reports on specific groups and also recommendations for how we can continue to address this issue in Illinois. And if it's all right, I would like to turn to a few slides. I can go through those pretty fast, particularly because Representative Ford did my job for me in laying out the hate crime statute. So I'll move through those pretty quickly and get to more of the national reports and state reports. Are you able to see my slides at this point? Okay, great. So we talked about hate crime requires two elements, both a bias motivation and also an underlying criminal act. And we talked about what those criminal actions could be. And the enhancing factor in the state crime law, state hate crime law, is that underlying crimes that would be a misdemeanor are bumped up to a felony if there is a hate or bias motivation involved.
One moment. Please, can we add Representative Mayfield to the roll? Thank you.
Will do.
Thank you. And I would add that since 2018, the Illinois Attorney General can also bring a civil action when there is a hate crime. Why do we treat hate crimes differently than other crimes? I think one of the key reasons is there is both an injury to the victim who experiences a hate crime, and then also to the community that was targeted for the particular issue of hate. And as I mentioned before, at various times in our nation's history, we've seen different groups targeted, whether it be Muslim Americans following the 9/11 attacks, whether it be Asian Americans during the pandemics. We want to really address the fact that attacking an individual instills fear, worry, concern in larger swaths of our communities. So one of the things that is pretty clear to those of us who work in the hate crime area is that hate crimes have always been and continue to be significantly underreported. There is a federal law passed in 1990 that requires the Attorney General to collect information about hate crimes, and they collect and publish this through the Uniform Crime Reporting Program. About 18,000 law enforcement agencies file reports each year, and law enforcement agencies cover all jurisdictions that can make arrests, including sheriff's departments, local police departments, campus police, and so on. What happens, though, in filing these reports is that about 86% of them file zero incidents of hate crime, and only about 14% of all LEAs, or local enforcement agents, law enforcement agencies, reported about 7,300 hate crimes in 2019. In 2020, we saw an increase to about 8,000 single bias incidents of hate crime. And those are according to the Bureau of Justice, the FBI's UCR reports. Pretty significantly over time, these factors that are shown in 2018 and 2019 reflect a pretty continuous trend, and the fact that throughout our history of collecting data, African-American community members have been the predominant target of hate crime in our nation, and that continues today. And at various points in time, there have been significant spikes and increases in other community groups being targeted. And again, these proportions that are laid out here reflect pretty much what we're seeing today. Within the religion category, there has been an increase in both anti-Muslim hate crime and in anti-Jewish hate crimes over the last few years. Now, I mentioned before that we believe that, let me just touch on the Illinois data for 2020. The total hate crimes reported to the FBI in 2020 was 75 in Illinois, and this is the breakdown of the categories. Now, as someone who has worked in hate crime over the years, I can tell you that there have been years where individual hate crime cases that I have worked on with a particular victim have gone unreported to the FBI and have not shown up in reports. And this kind of anecdotal evidence is borne out when you compare the total incidents that are reported to the FBI versus the kind of numbers that are reported to the Bureau of Justice Statistics through the National Crime Victims Survey. Each year, that survey does phone inquiries of households, and they're, you know, very well tested and highly regarded surveys where they ask about crimes and they ask about motivation for the crimes based on the victim's perception. And you can see the numbers here are dramatically different. While we average about 7,200 hate crimes reported to the FBI, over the BJS numbers over the last 10 years, we're talking about 242,000 a year average. About 44% of all crimes reported to BJS are reported to the police. Now, we know that law enforcement has a role in underreporting, and some of the reasons that we know cause this underreporting are a lack of incentive to collect the data and report. The fact that it's from the federal law, it's been basically an unfunded mandate and there were no penalties for doing it. There have been some incentives, but many of the jurisdictions lack the staffing or lack the motivation for doing it, frankly, because it's just doing more paperwork. And that's why we see many of them reporting zero hate crimes every year, repeatedly. And as I said, there have been years where I could point out cases that happened in a jurisdiction that go unreported. There's also at the direct sort of investigation of a hate crime issue, there's an issue of training of law enforcement officers about how to identify bias motivation, how to document that appropriately in police reports so that they will then be used in criminal prosecutions. All this is to say that the trends in underreporting mean that we don't really know the true nature of hate crime and hate violence in our nation and in our state. The other factor, of course, in underreporting is that victims often feel that they don't trust or understand how to report hate crime. They may lack the access. There may be cultural barriers. They may not even know what happened was a hate crime under our laws. When we talk to victims about why, some will say, well, I didn't feel like I could go to the police. I'm an undocumented immigrant, or I didn't feel I could go to the police. I've had bad run-ins with them before. Or I went to the police and they told me that there was nothing they could do. So what we have to do is both build trust in our community partners and community members that they can report hate crime and that when they do so, the police officers they report to will have the information and resources to respond appropriately. Last year, federal law, the Jabara Haya No Hate Act was passed, and this gives grants from the federal government to states for implementing a new and improved reporting system, the National Incident-Based Reporting System. And it also gives grants to states establishing hotlines and funding better procedures for hate crime investigation and reporting. what we know from best practices, reviewing all the literature, both internationally and in state pilot programs and so on, is that the greatest increase in reporting happens when victims have multiple opportunities to report through trusted community partner organizations, through internet apps. We saw during the last couple of years, there was significant use by Asian American community members of internet reporting systems that helped us really document the significant increase in crimes against that community. And what we really need to do is build better systems so we can effectively capture this data and then make appropriate recommendations on how to address this persistent crime. And with that, I'll wrap up my comments. I'd be happy to take any questions, but I think you'll get more specific information about particular groups from my colleagues who are up next.
And thank you for your presentation, and we appreciate you keeping it to just a little over 10 minutes. And that was great. We want to keep the time frame 10 minutes or less so that the last person isn't cut short. We know how that is. So thank you for your presentation. And we will move on to the next organization, the Center on Halsted. Please present. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Representative Ford. My name is Astor Gilbert, and I'm the manager of training and public education at the Center on Halsted. Without further ado, I will dive in. Let me share my screen here. All right, can everyone see the presentation? Okay, great. I will try to be quick within 10 minutes and not cover some of the same stuff. I'm gonna be talking specifically about anti-LGBTQ hate crimes, both nationwide and in Illinois. So to start, I want to mention that hate crime laws recognize two different categories that cover members of the LGBTQ community. This includes gender identity, which would cover people such as transgender, transsexual, non-binary, or gender non-conforming people. My colleague at Equality Illinois will be speaking more specifically about gender identity-focused hate crimes. But also the category of sexual orientation, which covers identities such as gay, lesbian, bisexual, et cetera. It's difficult to separate these two categories entirely in the data. So keep in mind that the information that we have covers a broad swath of different people. Furthermore, as I will be discussing and can take any questions on, these numbers vary based on other identity factors such as race, ethnicity, religious background, cultural origin, socioeconomic class, et cetera. Okay, so looking at some of the national trends, and this is drawing from similar data sets as what Julie Justice just mentioned, the FBI, the Department of Justice, as well as various organizations like the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Projects, of which I'm a member. So in general, the national trends are as follows. There has been a steady increase in anti-LGBTQ hate crimes nationwide since 2015. Some key points here. In 2019, we saw a major spike in violence against LGBTQ people. The Department of Justice and the FBI have data for 2020, which is the most recent year of collected data, and that shows an increase from that spike year of 2019. The Human Rights Campaign, as well as the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Projects, have reported what they refer to as an epidemic of violence and used the language of a public health crisis, particularly in the years 2021. And we are on track to see an increase in the year 2022. In general, sexual orientation as a category is consistently the second most targeted group across all victims of hate crimes. So as you can see in this graph here, which I sourced from the DOJ and FBI's website, race, ethnicity, and ancestry is typically the largest represented group of hate crime victims, but sexual orientation is most frequently the second. And as I already mentioned, apologies for the repetition, these rates vary based on race, ethnicity, national origin, and socioeconomic class. For example, in reports from 2019, Members of the Black community, Black LGBTQ people, represented 91% of homicide victims that were related to hate crimes. So as you can see, these numbers are significantly different. Furthermore, as you will hear later on from my friends and colleagues at the Chinese American Service League, there is a significant gap in available data in Asian American Pacific Islander folks who are LGBTQ. And so various organizations, we are beginning conversations to bridge that gap. When it comes to Illinois, and I apologize for the busyness of this slide, there's several different sections of information that I want to share. The graphs here on the side show, based on the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that there have been some decreases in hate crimes in Illinois for people based on sexual orientation. These numbers do fluctuate, but I also think it's important to keep in mind what Julie has already mentioned, is that there is massive underreporting. So we don't actually know what the real numbers are here. A couple things that I want to point out, and this is going to lead to my next slide, which is what is causing this rise and what are the unique factors affecting LGBTQ people. The Southern Poverty Law Center tracks hate groups nationwide, and they are currently tracking 23 active hate groups in the state of Illinois. Four of these hate groups are explicitly anti-LGBTQ in their mission and their ideology, but it is also important to look at white nationalism. There are seven white nationalist, neo-Nazi, and what's called neo-Volkish organizations. All of those are explicitly anti-LGBTQ as well. And there are also three organizations that are considered general hate, which includes the Proud Boys. Proud Boys have been actively engaged in harassment and violence against LGBTQ people, particularly in 2022. I also want to mention, and I can answer more about this if there are questions, is when looking at youth experience of hate, right? And this data is drawn from the Chicago public school system, who I work closely with. A lot of it's corroborated by the Chicago Police Department, who I also work with, the CDC, and the American Pediatric Association. So what we see in the confines of youth and grade school children is that LGBTQIA students face much higher rates of physical and digital bullying. This leads to the lowest rates of feeling safe within the school environment. And LGBTQ students also face higher rates of being punished. So for minor infractions, or punished for being bullied for being gay or transgender. This directly leads to higher rates of truancy, youth homelessness, drug use, and lifetime of substance abuse, as well as the increased likelihood of an LGBTQ student to bring a weapon into school for protection. So this data illustrates the ways that the environment of hate crimes actually ripples out or cascades out into a number of public health issues. So very briefly, I want to mention a couple things that are contributing to this rise, particularly in 2022. So in this year, 2022, we have seen a widespread national spread of what is called the grooming campaign, which is targeting LGBTQIA people by calling them groomers. This is language that comes from child sexual abuse activism. Essentially, this is scapegoating and stereotyping all LGBTQ people as violent sexual predators and pedophiles. This is represented in the 262 anti-LGBTQ bills that have been introduced nationwide since January of 2022. By April, this was already a record year for anti-LGBTQ legislation. We've also seen a continued rise in far right-wing extremist groups who typically have extremely anti-LGBTQ views. This ties in directly to a rise in the online radicalization of children, youth, and young adults, as many far-right extremist groups, white nationalist groups, actively target people on the internet to radicalize them against LGBTQ people. Furthermore, there are other issues. Again, this is very big for 10 minutes, but things like economic precarity, economic uncertainty, a growing crisis of legitimacy that people across the political spectrum feel in terms of faith in government or state institutions, as well as this perception of loss, the increased feeling that people are being, their rights are being taken away and given to minority groups. These elements are fueling radicalization, which is directly targeting LGBTQ people. Again, there's a lot more details I can share, but for the sake of time, I'm going to leave it at that. This leads into a couple, solutions or suggested areas of focus, things that I and other research organizations are working on, things that we need more data, right? So one is holistic approaches that tackle economic inequality and racial disparities, right? It's very difficult to just look at LGBTQ hate and bias incidents in isolation. Oftentimes, anti-LGBTQ views are very deeply tied together with anti-Semitism, with Islam. Islamophobic and anti-Arab sentiments, anti-Black racism, all different forms of discrimination. There is also conversations happening about the need to fund or think about preventative solutions, right? And what I mean by that is changing the culture, changing the landscape to lessen the amount of hate crime incidents, which Illinois is doing a lot of great work with the hate crimes laws and statutes. But for example, police are limited to responding to a hate crime incident after it occurs, right? And increasingly police are tasked with a number of different responsibilities that they are not always equipped with. In defense of the police force, right, as someone who trains police officers, they are often given an overwhelming amount of training about a lot of different topics and specific community issues. So they are doing a lot. There's need for funding community organizations, service providers, healthcare providers, education networks, right? The people that are able to tap into or members of these communities that are aware of the specific needs of LGBTQ communities. There is always a need for more research and specifically shared and transparent aggregated data, which has already been discussed, but also protecting and funding the institutions that are currently being targeted with this campaign of grooming or groomers, which include public schools, comprehensive sex education, and public libraries. And lastly, there is a need to consider hate crimes beyond just single state solutions, but as cross-state or federal solutions, right? The networks of anti-LGBTQ groups and their funders are national and federal organizations. These are very complex networks. I see I'm at time, so I had some examples, but I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much for your time. I will stop there.
Thank you very much. And we will keep it going. We will go right now to Equality Illinois. Equality Illinois, if you're here, please state your name for the record and begin.
Sure. It's Mike Ziri, Director of Public Policy at Equality Illinois. Thank you, Chair Ford and Chair Hurley and the task force for organizing this hearing today. I'm going to talk about more some of the things we are seeing on the ground, building on the comments that Aster just presented. So let me open my PowerPoint. Great. And as Aster mentioned, what we're seeing across the country is really the most ever anti-LGBTQ plus bills ever introduced. As of April, it was in the 250 range, but most recently it's up to more than 300 anti-LGBTQs introduced across the country, the most ever. And the these bills run the gamut from the infamous Florida Don't Say Gay bill to bills to deny healthcare to trans youth, to deny trans youth opportunities to fully engage in schools. So there's a wide variety. Most of these bills have been targeting trans youth. And so what the impact of that has been is, for instance, after Florida Governor DeSantis signed the Don't Say Gay bill a few months ago, that anti-LGBTQ rhetoric surged online, 406% increase in anti-LGBTQ hate speech online, Twitter, and other platforms. And so the effect of that in Illinois has been what we've seen is really an unprecedented number of reports of harassment, bullying of LGBTQ youth coming to us, coming to our partners at the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, regional partners, and and also as an increase in actions at school board meetings, at public library board meetings, to ban books essentially in schools and in libraries, books that acknowledge the existence and the lived experience of LGBTQ people, but not just LGBTQ people. Attempts to ban books about the civil rights movement, about Black history, Latinx history, the history of marginalized communities, what we're seeing. And what that really is, it's an attack on who belongs and how students see themselves and how people see themselves in the content they're provided in classrooms and in broader society, and the impacts of that, what we're seeing in Illinois. And we continue to receive these reports of harassment, bullying, et cetera. And, you know, these are just other examples here. Aster mentioned the Proud Boys, you know, coming and being part of these efforts, the violence and the online extremism, for instance, in Downers Grove, but in other communities as well, in the suburbs of Chicago and the collar counties. Also, this violence is fueling that bullying and harassment among students. And this is a headline from a school district in Southern Illinois. And so the impact of all this is that, you know, this online extremism, this bullying, can take the form of very real physical violence. And this is a recent incident in Washington, D.C., which ties together anti-LGBTQ sentiments and monkeypox, which the stigma around monkeypox as it relates to the LGBTQ communities being weaponized by the far right as part of the anti-LGBTQ hate efforts, and something we're very concerned about with that stigma that is being presented about monkeypox and anti-LGBTQ hate. But also, even closer to home, that online extremism has manifested itself in vandalism and violence here in McHenry County recently, last month, where a bakery and cafe that was going to host a drag show was threatened, protested, leading up to what would have been the drag show on July 23rd, but then the morning of the drag show, the uprising bakery and cafe was vandalized, and not just vandalized, windows smashed, et cetera, but also had that word rumor spray painted on the side of the building. And the individual was arrested and is being charged with a hate crime and has connections to the Proud Boys. But an example of how those hate crimes, how that online extremism can become very quickly the physical violence and vandalism and damage to property and harm to people. And this all matters in ways that we may not think are hate crimes. And I know Aster mentioned some data, but I really want to point out one piece of data from the Trevor Project this year in their mental health survey, in that LGBTQ youth are 2.5 times more likely to attempt suicide in communities that are very unaccepting of LGBTQ people compared to communities that are very accepting. And this kind of hateful rhetoric, the online extremism, the physical violence, the chilling effect that has on the LGBTQ community, I think is reflected, you know, as part of this, as part of the mental health, the well-being of LGBTQ youth. And one reason why I would also say that the General Assembly's work for inclusive curriculum, a few years ago, the legislature passed the bill to require LGBTQ history be taught in public schools. Why the TEACH Act was so important. Why Representative Ford, your work to strengthen Black history is so important. It goes to this data about very unaccepting versus accepting communities and that rhetoric. And just want to quickly also just mention the increasing anti-trans rhetoric, the introduction and passage of all these anti-trans laws in their states, and decades of social stigma and discrimination have contributed also to an epidemic of violence against trans people, particularly trans people of color. And just some data to share, almost 30% of trans folks experience poverty in the United States, compared to about 15% for non-LGBTQ folks. 80% of trans individuals in Illinois have experienced some form of mistreatment in schools. K through 12 schools because folks thought they were trans. 28% of trans individuals in Illinois report being denied a promotion, not being hired, being fired because of their gender identity or expression. And about a quarter of trans individuals in Illinois don't go to the doctor when they need to because they're afraid of how they'll be treated. And I share this data because it forms the social conditions for the violence against trans folks, with last year being the deadliest year on record for trans people and non-binary folks in the United States. That at least 50 trans folks were killed last year that we know of. There are many more because someone would be misgendered or not identified, et cetera. And we're seeing, increasing violence this year as well as we go on, and just only halfway through the year. And then compounding the tragedy of the violence against trans folks is a lack of investment by public and private entities to provide opportunities such as workforce development, housing, access to affirming healthcare, and then also lack of resources directed to investigate the murders of trans folks. Two major issues here compounding the tragedy of the increasing violence and hate crimes. And then to Julie's point earlier about why some folks may not be comfortable reporting a hate crime or violence to law enforcement, here's some national data. Particularly, I want to point out 56% of trans people report they didn't call the police when they needed help. And I think that goes probably to the third point, which is almost half of LGBTQ plus people who experience violence were mistreated by a member of law enforcement. So I think there's, to Julie's point earlier, there's some mistrust and some work that needs to be done by law enforcement to build trust and support among the LGBTQ plus community, including trans folks. Thank you for the time today, and happy to answer questions later on.
Thank you for your timely presentation, and thank you for reaching out to ask for this hearing. I think at this point, it would be a good idea to do two things. One, open it up for a few minutes of questions, and two, pause for a moment of silence for all those people that have been lost to this violence of hate crime. People's lives have been lost. So let us pause for a moment. Thank you, Mike. Chair Hurley, we want to pause for a moment for questions. If anyone have questions at this time for the presenters, feel free to ask. We're doing great on time. Thank you all. If not, we move right along to our next presenter, and that will be the Chinese American Service Lead. Are you present?
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Representative Ford.
Good morning,
everyone. My name is Abby Sebio, and I serve as the Anti-Hate Action Center Manager here at the Chinese American Service League, CASEL for short. And thank you for the opportunity to join the hearing today to give kind of a quick overview of our work at the center and talk about, of course, the issues affecting our AA and HPI community. So I will try to now share my screen. Okay, hopefully everyone can see.
Yes, we can see it, maybe.
Great, okay, thanks. So CASEL continues to be the largest nonprofit in the Midwest of direct services for the AA and HPI community. And CASEL, along with Asian Human Services in Oakland and the Asian American Federation in New York, were chosen to pilot an AAPI Action Center focusing on responding to and tracking hate crimes and hate incidents and protecting AA and HPI communities and ultimately preventing further incidents from occurring. And according to the Center for the Study on Hate and Extremism, anti-Asian hate incidents are up 339% since last year, while 30% of Americans think that incidents have actually decreased or no longer exist. So the hate incidents and hate crimes are experiencing while are increasing, while more people are actually thinking that it no longer even is happening. So that's a glaring statistic there. And we prioritize the need to address the underreporting of hate crimes and hate incidents in the Midwest and the implementation of the four pillars of the Anti-Hate Action Center And so as you can see here, our first pillar is around response. And CASEL is able to connect clients to legal services through our legal services department. We're able to connect individuals to mental health support through our behavioral health clinic. And we can provide assistance completing the crime victims compensation application administered through the Illinois Attorney General's office. And we're able to assist individuals filling out the Social Security disability application. And our second pillar, tracking, we encourage individuals to report both hate crimes and hate incidents. We have a hate crime report form on our website, but individuals are, of course, welcome to contact us by phone, email, or in person. And we have the anecdotal data, but we are working to gather as much of that quantitative data as much as possible, because that will only help provide a more accurate picture of the scope of the issues that are affecting our ANHPI community and that they are experiencing the trauma as a result of anti-Asian hate. And as mentioned before, we all know that we have limited data with law enforcement. And so we're working to empower the AAPI community as they address the cultural stigma that they sometimes struggle with, which is the fear that they sometimes will be shamed by bringing any negative attention to oneself, even though they are the ones that are victimized in a hate crime or hate incident. And our third pillar around protection. So we are working closely with law enforcement, their crime victims, advocates, government agencies, and bar associations to make sure that individuals know of their legal rights and legal protections. And hate incidents, as we know, are not prosecutable, but it is imperative that they report them as well. And according to StopAPIHate.org's National March 2022 report, verbal harassment is up 63%. They make up 63% of anti-Asian hate incidents. And our fourth pillar, prevention, is really actually what we're most excited about, because we're working to really create that awareness around all these issues. And based on information collected from the Asian American Foundation, again, education is going to be key. And we want to make sure that the anti-hate
action. Your slide is not moving. Representative LaPointe called it out. Could you move to your point?
Apologies. Okay, great. Thank you. And so what we want to make sure that we're doing is addressing the different issues that are coming already through our clients when they report hate crimes and hate incidents. And what we've learned so far is that we're getting more reports of discrimination based on race in the workplace while trying to get medical treatment in hospitals and also in relation to housing matters. And so this shows that the immigrant community wants guidance on how to combat discrimination in all these different areas. And they want their story and voice to be heard, and they want an advocate who will be with them every step of the way when they're trying to address the trauma that they're experiencing from a hate crime or hate incident. And the Anti-Hate Action Center is working with partner organizations to build awareness and education around what the difference is between a hate crime and a hate incident. Where can I go for help? What can actually be done? And we're working to also empower the Asian American community to feel safe and comfortable to ask for help. We're partnering with the consulates because we found that sometimes they are actually the first office that our immigrant community goes to when trying to get help for a hate crime or hate incident. And it's best that we do work together to advise these individuals of options to support them to make sure that such discrimination does not happen again. So according to the Status Index, which is a comprehensive annual assessment of attitudes and stereotypes about Asian Americans, you'll see here some of their key findings, and this is a national report. And what we're also seeing that is that the myth of the perpetual foreigner continues to affect the feeling of belonging for Asian Americans in America. And so Asian Americans are actually the least likely racial group in the US to feel that they completely belong. And 29% of Asian Americans completely agree that they feel that they belong and are accepted fully into the US, compared to 61% of white Americans. And so the why of what we do at the Anti-Hate Action Center is around accessibility and equity in resources and the visibility of our stories and voices and our needs. And we've already piloted a couple of hate crime workshops with our partner youth programs here in Chinatown, as well as with our seniors at CASEL's Adult Day Services. And some of the objectives of our hate crimes workshops are to gain an understanding of Chicago's Asian American communities, history and culture, dismantle stereotypes that persist about Asian American people, and develop awareness for identifying and responding to anti-Asian hate and bullying. And the AANHPI youth we have spoken to already through our hate crimes workshops have said that they've experienced hate incidents in public places like on the train or at a store. And they actually feel the most uncomfortable talking about issues about hate and the model minority myth at home and with their family and friends. And so as many of you know already, the model minority myth refers to a minority group being perceived as a particularly successful in relation to other minority groups. And frequently this term is applied to Asian Americans and has been criticized as a form of stereotyping that also ignores or obscures not only the racism and discrimination that Asian Americans face, but also the wide diversity among Asian Americans. And according to a 2020 Stop API Hates Youth Report, 1 in 4 AAPI youth experience bullying, and 50% of the youth in the study expressed sadness or depression as a result of bullying. And 25% of them said that they were scared for themselves and their families. And also according to the CDC, the leading cause of death for AAPI youth ages 15 to 24 is suicide. Aster at Center for Halsted had talked about, of course, issues that are affecting our LGBTQ youth, but also the Trevor Project, the LGBTQ advocacy group, found in their survey released earlier this spring that 40% of AAPI LGBTQ youth seriously considered suicide in the past year. And also the youth that do experience prejudice based on race or immigration status also found higher rates of suicide attempts. So a large part of the issues that we're also experiencing when AAPI youth talk about hate incidents that they're experiencing in schools is that many of them said that actually an adult was present but never intervened. So building that trusted relationship is going to be imperative in supporting our youth. And a large part of this can be because teachers, administrators may not know how to recognize anti-Asian bullying. And so we wanna make sure that we are supporting them and trying to, of course, address this. So we at the Anti-Hate Action Center actually recently partnered with SALDEF to provide workshops on anti-Asian bullying prevention efforts for CBD school resource officers along with Astra Center in Halsted. And then we did a similar training with DCFS to staff them with knowledge on how to identify and intervene during an anti-Asian hate crime incident. And so we wanna make sure that again, we're amplifying the same sentiments on supporting the implementation of the TEACH Act. And we really need to continue to work together to provide the most comprehensive services around these issues and being that trusted advocate for our Asian American community. So thank you. Just also providing contact information there. But thank you again for the opportunity to speak today.
We did not get to see your slide 4 and 5. I don't know.
Oh.
Did not move.
Apologies about that. Sorry.
Did you want to move them just so that, or is it okay?
Is everyone able to see them now?
No.
Okay. Apologies. How about now? No, still no.
No.
Okay.
Okay, that's fine. You've okay. gone over it. And so I see you have additional information on one. So you've talked about that, right?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. We're going to move right along to our next presenter, which will be the Council of Islamic Organization of Greater Chicago. Are you present?
Here.
Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, everyone. And thank you, Chair Ford, for having us today. Co-Chair Harley and fellow presenters and the witnesses who are present with us today. Thank you for including Muslim Voice as a part of this very important initiative, the Council of Islamic Organization of Greater Chicago. We are in 30 years of existence, and the council was created for this role to vocalize the experiences of our Muslim communities, as we represent over 500,000 Muslims in the Chicagoland area. Our organization consists of 70 plus mosques, Islamic institutions, schools, and service organizations. The council is proud to be the face of the Muslim community and is the largest Muslim organization across the state of Illinois. We have been on the forefront of addressing the hate crimes locally and across the state. The trend, which contributes especially to the Muslim community, are rooted in the false narratives presented to the general American population, which perpetuate the feelings of animosities towards the Muslim American community. I do have a presentation to share, Chair Ford. I'm not sure if I can screen it or share my screen, or is that gonna be shared?
Let's ask the clerk. Clerk, how will we go?
Mr. Khan, you can screen share if you wish, or I can do it if you're having trouble.
Okay, can you see my screen now?
Yes.
Okay. I kept this presentation very brief and very high level, and sharing some of the Muslim perspective on this hate crimes. I have a situations that sharing with the committee here, and also some proposed solution. And this is no different than what other presenters have shared with you all regarding the hate crime, and Muslim community is no different than what other communities have been facing some of that. The main reason in my mind, if you can see my second screen, how it is manifested. It's manifested towards bomb threats, intruders trespassing mosques and schools, vandalizing of the workshop, house of worship facilities, threats of violence against specific mosques, and public threats of the violence. Just to give an example of some of these manifested, the bomb threat against were made against one of our member of Islamic Downtown Center and also one of the mosque in Southside in 2018 up to 2020. FBI intercepted three men actually with assembled bombs who were plotting to bomb the mosque in the Illinois in 2022. Two Muslim schools were surveillanced and unauthorized entry on those premises on the third school. Vandalism of the house of worship facilities, spray paints, brick thrown at the windows, and threats to eradicate Islam against members of our community in Champaign-Urbana. What we believe, what are the contributing factors, is a religious and cultural bias, as has been shared with a lot of our presenters today. Public hearing used as a forum to spread disinformation about Muslims, especially in the case of Naperville hearing regarding the mosque zoning process. Negative portrayal and disinformation about Muslims by elected officials. Negative portrayal and disinformation about Muslims in the media. Proposed solution that I have to share with all of you in a broader terms, not presenting any data and solutions, developing a policy, how we can promote reporting of these hate crimes. I think most of my presenters before me have shared, this is a major issue that we see is in the reporting of those hate crimes. And we got to have a policy that develops how we can promote the reporting of those hate crimes. I highly suggest formation of advocacy council charged with monitoring the commission of the hate crimes in Illinois and offering policies to abate these hate crimes. Lastly, promotion of training in public schools to raise the awareness and sensitivity of the diverse ethnic and religious communities across the state of Illinois. Illinois is a welcoming state, And we are so proud to be part of one of the Illinois community that have always opened arms and welcomed the Muslim community, especially our refugees community who is coming in the state of Illinois, the Afghan community, which just started landing here in the state of Illinois. And we feel there's a lot of openness in the state of Illinois in welcoming and how we can promote this further initiatives of being working together. In the end, Chair, and the task force, I have provided some of the references to the BAO task that was presented. And at this time, I really do want to thank you all for your time. The council is dedicated in finding real solutions. Chair Ford, as you mentioned in your previous hearing, that we need to find real solutions and working towards creating a safer environment for all Illinoisans and including the Muslim community. I truly believe a positive interaction, education, dispelling stereotypes would really go long ways in building bridges. Once an individual makes a room in their mind and heart to accept anyone who's different, and we are in a win-win situation at that point. Council is here to help and partner these initiatives, and I look forward to contributing to this initiative. And I do want to, in close, want to thank you all for giving me an opportunity as a council chair for sharing some of my thoughts from Muslim perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we're going to move right to the Indian American Council. Are you present?
Yes. Give me a second, please. I'll just... Yes, thank you so much for this opportunity, honorable members, honorable speaker, chair of the committee. My name is Ajit Sahi, and I represent the Indian American Muslim Council. I want to talk about the hate that is being brought into the United States, across the United States, by an ideology which has been globally identified as supremacism, Hindu supremacism. I am a Hindu myself. And I work with, and I'm a proud Hindu. I was born and raised a Hindu. I belong to a Hindu family. I work with an organization founded by Muslims of Indian origin in the United States of America. But we work very closely with all organizations that are devoted and dedicated to civil rights work, from Black Lives Matter to NAACP to Jewish Voice for Peace. We work with Hindu organizations, Muslim organizations. We work very closely with CIOGC. We work with the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And we work also very closely with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, which is based in Washington, D.C., and which, as you know, is a federal panel commission to which commissioners are appointed by leaders of both house, both parties in the United States Congress. I will start by talking about an event that occurred as recently as 10 days ago. Two incidents, actually. They are not from the state of Illinois, but they have great consequences from the state of Illinois, for the state of Illinois. The first incident occurred on 14th of August at a parade that had been called in the state of New Jersey in the cities of Edison and Woodbridge. And the parade was called to mark the 75th Freedom Independence Day of India for India. From freedom from British colonial rule that happened in 1947. I'm proud of that heritage. However, there was an extreme divisive element in that parade, the use of a bulldozer. Now, people who are not aware of what a bulldozer stands, it is Black Lives Matter has released a statement in the last 3 days saying the use of the bulldozer in that parade is the same as the use of the noose by the white racists in America, that it was meant to terrorize the African-American people in the United States of America. The bulldozer has become a weapon of choice for Hindu supremacist administrations across India and different states to target Muslim communities, Muslim-owned homes, Muslim-owned businesses, Muslim places of worship, such as mosques, which are being demolished using the bulldozer to terrorize the Muslim community. This has been written about by New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, the BBC, Al Jazeera, CNN. It's been reported very widely. It has been condemned by Amnesty International USA as a hate crime in India. To bring a bulldozer in a parade in New Jersey has shocked the community. As I was on this call just before this meeting started, there have been a slew of members of town councils and people from House of Delegates in New Jersey, representatives of different civil rights organizations that have overwhelmingly condemned the use of the bulldozer. Now, the organizers of that parade called Indian Business Association has actually doubled down. And they are saying, much like the white racists used to say that the noose is a symbol of law and order, they are now saying that the bulldozer is a symbol of law and order. Now, this is something that perhaps some of you honorable members of the Illinois House of Delegates are aware of, the insidious ideology of Hindu supremacism, which is exactly the same as anti-Semitism. In fact, the ideology of Hindu supremacism was founded in India 100 years ago, and it had close encounters and collaborations, and it was deeply inspired by the Nazis and Mussolini's fascists in Italy. And this has been documented by the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. There are multiple lawmakers from US Congress who have called it out. This has been going on for quite a few years, but now this is boiling over onto the streets of the United States. In California, in the city of Anaheim, on 15th of August, we saw people at Hindu supremacists at an Independence Day parade assault protesters, people who were protesting. Now, this, as we know very well, there was and the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago knows this very well. I'm assuming that this has been brought to the notice of the Illinois House of Delegates. There was massive opposition to the plans to build a mosque right here in Illinois in the city of Naperville a couple of years ago that festered for a long time. And it was found that much of that opposition was not coming from the residents of Illinois, but it was coming from the residents of Naperville, but it was coming from outside the residents of Naperville, from outside of Naperville, from even outside of Illinois. Now, this is an ideology. This may not rise to the level of a hate crime, but this is definitely a hate ideology. It has wide roots in the state of Illinois. This needs to be investigated. If you need to check with the NAACP, with the Black Lives Matter, or with Amnesty International, with Human Rights Watch, everybody is cognizant of this ideology. This is very unfortunate because not only is it dividing the great Indian American community, it is also dividing. It is also dividing the wider American community because this. I cannot recall. I work as an advocacy person. I deal with American politicians, lawmakers. I cannot recall any other idea. People are followers of any idea, other ideology. You will hardly find Muslims in America who are followers of any kind of extreme Islamic ideology. So I will stop here. Thank you so much for the opportunity given to me to speak here today. And I'm very happy to take any questions that you may have. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to refrain from questions. I guess no one has questions right now. Please stand by if you don't mind. Thank you for the presentation. We're going to move right along to our next presenter, which will be the Jewish United Fund, Jewish Federation of Chicago, and the Midwest Regional Director. Is that the group that we're? Yes, please proceed. Hello, there's the anti-deformation of.
Yeah. Dan, do you want to speak first or would you like me to? Okay. Can't hear you, but I think you said me. All right. Well, thank you so much, Chairman Ford and Co-Chair Hurley. My name is David Goldenberg. I'm the ADL Midwest Regional Director based here in Chicago. And I realize that we are coming at a point where you all have been listening quite often and are listening to a lot, and we may be standing in the way between dinner or lunch and everybody else. And so I will be brief, but just talking through a little bit about the state of anti-Semitism in America and Illinois. as many of you may be familiar with. For those of you who don't know about the Anti-Defamation League, ADL was founded actually in Chicago in 1913 with the mission to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment for all. And the work that we really do is fighting anti-Semitism, bigotry, bias, and discrimination, extremism, and cyber hate. We do it through investigations and research, education and training, and advocacy and assisting. And when I say assisting, I mean also assisting victims of hate crimes and hate incidents as well. So when we look at anti-Semitic attitudes, ADL has been taking surveys, what we call our Global 100 survey, for the last 40 plus years. Now, as you can imagine, you can't just call someone up on the phone and say, hey, are you anti-Semitic? And they say yes or no. But instead we take a look at 11 historical anti-Semitic tropes. Jews have too much power in the world. Jews control the media. Jews, charges of dual loyalty. Jews are more loyal to Israel than other than the country that they live in. And we do this in over 100 countries around the world. And I wanted to share anti-Semitic attitudes in the United States, dating back to the mid-1960s. And you can see the height back in 1964. And you can see the most recent comprehensive survey that we did a few years ago here in the US showed that anti-Semitic attitudes were down to about 11%. I mean, they largely really haven't changed so much in the last 20 years. And I want us to remember this data point, but also still understanding that nearly a third of Americans think that Jews are responsible for the death of Jesus, despite the fact that every major Christian denomination has come out and said it's not true. A quarter think that Jews are more loyal to Israel than America. 20% of Jews talk about too much about the Holocaust, and you can see this. And so I want us to remember these data points from attitudes when I share these next couple data points. So ADL has been tracking anti-Semitic incidents, incidents of harassment, vandalism, and assault since 1974. And the last four of the last 5 years have been the four highest total number of anti-Semitic incidents. So occurring at a time when attitudes are historically low, but we have seen dramatic increases. So for example, nationally, we've seen 114% increase in anti-Semitic incidents since 2016, which is again, as I said, the highest total number. We also have seen 167% increase in assaults, a 61% increase in incidents targeting Jewish institutions. We've seen a dramatic increase in anti-Semitic propaganda by white supremacist groups. And we also, for the first time, saw incidents reported in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. We also saw a dramatic increase in anti-Semitism in schools. You can see a 61% increase in K-12 schools. That was a particular incident earlier this year in Oak Park River Forest High School. And we also saw a dramatic increase in a more than doubling in the number of anti-Semitic incidents reported at colleges and universities. The graphic on the right displaying different anti-Semitic images comparing Jews to pigs using imagery that is clearly anti-Semitic was posted by a student organization at the University of Chicago late last year to its Instagram feed. In the Midwest, we've seen a 62% increase since 2020 and a 200% increase if we go back to 2016. Here in Illinois, to give you a sense, we saw a 15% year-over-year increase in the number of anti-Semitic incidents from 2020 to 2021. But when you look at the larger trend and you go back 5 years, a 430% increase, which is quite dramatic. And these numbers align with when we look at hate crimes reported by the FBI that Julie and others spoke about earlier. You can see that of the roughly 15 to 20% of all hate crimes being religion-based, overwhelmingly they've targeted the Jewish community, followed by the Muslim and then the Hindu community. You can see historically over the last 20 years, the dark blue trend at the top, and I'm going quickly, and if we can include this report in the record, folks can look at this more in detail, but you can see that anti-Jewish hate crimes have historically been the largest number of religious-based hate crimes. But you can see different trends growing in the Sikh community, Muslim in the Muslim community or anti-Islamic community. You can see sort of the different trends dating back to 2001, right after September 11th. But you can see the trends over the last 20 years. some recent incidents that I mentioned, that I'll start here on the left and go kind of upper left and go clockwise. The upper left-hand corner was an incident in West Rogers Park where a kosher grocery store was vandalized. Also in the middle on the top is a swastika painted on a synagogue in Rogers Park. On the right-hand side is an individual throwing an object at the Hillel Jewish Student Center down at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign while they were having a celebration during Passover. That individual has since been charged with a hate crime. The bottom is a synagogue that was vandalized in Skokie. In the lower left-hand corner was a sign taken. We saw a lot of Nazi comparisons during the stay-at-home protests, as many of you might remember earlier in COVID. We've also tracked a dramatic increase in the distribution of anti-Semitic propaganda by white supremacists. Just in the last 6 months, ADL has received almost 24 reports of anti-Semitic propaganda in Illinois just over the last 6 months. And you can see the cities where it's reported, and on the right-hand side, the dots showing exactly where they were in the state. Now, so what are these things suggesting? If you remember going back to those historical anti-Semitic tropes, these are some of the flyers that we've seen. Blaming Jews for the spread of COVID and that everything regarding COVID is Jewish. On the right-hand side, every aspect of the Biden administration is Jewish. Again, all falsehoods, but playing into anti-Semitic tropes that Jews are in control. Now we go then into other issues. And these, by the way, have all been reported literally in the last week, being distributed either in Illinois, in the Midwest, or other parts of the country. Every single aspect of mass immigration is Jewish on the left, in the middle, abortion, on the right, gun control. And so we continue to see this coming from white supremacist groups. And these are distributed usually in the darkness of the night to homes, although they're not typically targeting Jewish institutions or Jewish individuals. They are intended to spread hate and fear in the community. So as we think about where things stand right now and this group comes together, number one, I will first say that we very much support the recommendations of the Commission on Discrimination and Hate Crimes, of which I'm proud to serve as a member and that Director Bennett's going to talk about. But first and foremost, we've got to address underreporting of hate crimes. You've heard the data points, but we need to address issues as it relates to law enforcement numbers, and then also barriers to reporting by victims and communities. We want to encourage a mandate for hate crimes training for law enforcement. My colleagues and other organizations have talked about this more. We need to start holding social media companies responsible for spreading hate and misinformation on their platforms. We've seen the impact that those have had. And then lastly, we all need to work together to continue to speak out, share facts, and show strength in the face of hate and bigotry. I'll close in my last, I think, 45 seconds, if my time is right, Mr. Chairman, by saying immediately after the shooting in Buffalo earlier this year, ADL, working with the Chicago Urban League and LULAC Illinois, convened a group of around 35 or 40 of us, and some folks who are on this call were on that, including Director Bennett. And we call it an anti-hate table. And it was an opportunity for people to sort of decompress and talk. And we asked everyone the question of, what are you most concerned about in the aftermath of Buffalo? And to a T, and we had pretty much every community you can think of, but to a T, everyone responded with, my community could be next. So having this conversation right now about hate crimes is so important, and I applaud the leadership of the General Assembly and appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, you guys had a trio. I think who are you going to call on next, David?
Dan Goldwin, who's my colleague at the Jewish United Fund.
You can hear you. I can't hear you. Maybe someone else can.
No, we can't hear you, Dan.
Are you able to hear me now?
Yes. Would echo.
But mute your video.
There we go. Is that any better?
Mr. It's better because we can hear you, but it's still not smooth.
Yeah, turn down your sound on your computer.
How about now?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-oh. I see you have two entries into this meeting, and that could be the problem. You want to close one out?
There we go.
I think that's good. Let's hear you now.
Okay, I apologize for technical issues. You'd think by now we'd have all this set. Thank you everybody for inviting me to speak this morning. My name is Dan Goldwin. I am the Executive Director of Public Affairs for the Jewish United Fund, Jewish Federation of Chicago, also known as JUF. As David Goldenberg said, I know we're reaching the end of a long meeting, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief. But I do want to start by thanking Task Force Chairs, Representatives LaShawn Ford and Fran Hurley for hosting this important conversation and for inviting JUF. JUF is the central organizing, advocacy, and fundraising arm for Metropolitan Chicago's 320,000 Jewish residents. Last year, our network of more than 70 agencies provided healthcare, human services, and education to more than 500,000 people of all faiths, ages, abilities, ethnicities, and economic circumstances. From Sinai Hospital to the Jewish Children and Family Services to the Jewish Community Centers of Chicago, our network of affiliated agencies are providing invaluable services, often safety net services, to thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. As my friend David Goldenberg just said, anti-Semitism is real and it is growing in America, in Illinois, and in Chicago. Unfortunately, while anti-Semitic threats are surging in our country, as each of the prior speakers made clear, Jews are not the only community feeling under siege. Now, I chose that word siege purposely because what it means in real and practical terms. When a community or a people feel under siege, their instinct can be to turn inward and look for ways to protect themselves from whatever malevolent forces are bearing down upon them. When communities turn inward to focus on self-preservation, they are forced to divert scarce resources and assume a defensive posture. They may scale back initiatives and goals intended to help their own and the broader community. They may stop innovating for good, and they may even lose sight of primary missions. This will be the focus of my remarks. What is the real-world impact on communal organizations like JUF that are now steering fundraising resources towards capital security improvements, active shooter trainings, contract security guards, emergency response, video monitoring, and away from critical human infrastructure investments that our partners and programs rely on to serve numerous communities each and every day? More specifically, what does it mean for those 500,000 people served by JUF's network of affiliated agencies? The JUF and those safety net agencies are now having to spend increasing amounts of scarce charitable and government dollars on security as opposed to direct health and human services. In Chicago, JUF affiliated agencies start each budget cycle collectively spending at least $5 million a year on security-related expenses, such as guards, cameras, trainings, enhanced communication tools. That's $5 million a year they cannot allocate to direct services, including food for the hungry, medicine for the sick, housing for the homeless, treatment for those with mental health challenges, and education for children with special needs. It is also important to note that that $5 million is a dramatic undercount of what is actually spent. It does not include capital security improvements, and it does not include Jewish agencies and organizations that are not grantees of JUF. Separate from JUF's affiliated agencies' annual security expenses, JUF alone, my employer, is spending $1.2 million a year annually on security for our staff, volunteers, and infrastructure. To help our community improve their security over the last 2 years, JUF gave out $1.6 million in security matching grants to 88 different Jewish organizations. They then raised $2.3 million to match their grants from us on their own. On top of direct payments to grantee organizations, just over the last year, JUF's security team has received nearly 90 requests for security evaluations and assistance. JUF conducted 41 comprehensive security site audits and 25 security trainings. 2 weeks ago, we launched a security survey to hundreds of synagogues, Jewish organizations, schools, camps, senior facilities, and early childhood centers. We suspect the response from those surveys are going to only increase the demand for resources and assistance. Recognizing that the need far outstrips the resources, in 2021, JUF launched a multi-million dollar endowment campaign called Live Secure Chicago with one simple yet difficult goal: help ensure that Jewish institutions and our Jewish community can safely gather without having to compromise because of our security concerns. This campaign will succeed in raising money for security grants for Jewish organizations, but at what cost? This is money that will not be raised to meet the health, human services, and educational needs of many of Chicago's most vulnerable citizens. The good news amongst this dire report, however, is that we know we have partners in government and throughout the community that want to tackle this problem with us. In the last legislative session, Governor Pritzker proposed and the General Assembly passed an FY23 budget that includes $20 million to fund the Illinois Nonprofit Security Grant Program, a program that had never received an appropriation since it was created in 2017. With this allocation, Illinois has the third largest state program after New York and California. Part of JUF's advocacy for funding this program in Illinois was spearheading the Safeguard Illinois Communities Coalition, a diverse group of 52 nonprofit cultural, civic, religious, racial, and ethnic organizations that were and are committed to two interrelated goals. First, the inclusion of nonprofit security grant program funding in this year's state budget, and two, implementation of the program that is navigable, accessible, and equitably distributed to all eligible entities. The coalition's membership included representatives from the Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Asian American, LGBTQ, Black, and Latino institutions, and other organizations whose communities may be vulnerable to attacks and hate-motivated violence. The $20 million appropriation also received official endorsements from Illinois' legislative Black, Jewish, Asian American, and Latino caucuses, as well as the Illinois Commission on Discrimination and Hate Crimes. There are, however, still critical challenges in front of us to make this program work. First, the Illinois Emergency Management Agency, who will oversee grant making, must develop rules and a grant application process. The coalition developed detailed recommendations in May and was very recently provided an opportunity to comment on pre-filing draft program rules before official first notice rulemaking commences. Unfortunately, the rules we reviewed, should they become final, are likely too complex and too burdensome for most small and even medium-sized nonprofits like churches, mosques, temples, synagogues, and neighborhood community centers to complete. Second, the draft we received was modeled after the federal nonprofit security grant program. The federal program is a critical initiative and irreplaceable, but it is also one that has a notoriously difficult application to complete. The draft rules we reviewed are effectively requiring grantees to front all expenses for approved security improvements so that the state can reimburse them later. Most nonprofits do not have the necessary cash reserves or ability to borrow sufficiently to do so. JUF has worked with the Safeguard Illinois Community Coalition and sent comments and recommendations to IEMA to the pre-filing draft rules and recommendations on how to make the grant application requirements more reasonable and accessible, and will definitely comment during official rulemaking and will continue to find ways to support the coalition. We do know, however, we could use the General Assembly's help to ensure that the Illinois Nonprofit Security Grant Program is rolled out in such a way that the organizations who are most vulnerable to acts of hate and extremism and in need of security hardening, security training, and contract security are informed of the funding opportunity and are able to access those funds. According to JUF's recently completed population survey, 69% of Jewish adults living in metropolitan Chicago are very concerned about anti-Semitism in our country. And as was made clear earlier, those fears are not misplaced. It is because of those fears, because of events like we experienced in Pittsburgh, Poway, California, West Rogers Park, Colleyville, Texas, Skokie, and here in the Loop, and the list goes on, that the Jewish community is now investing larger and larger sums into securing our institutions and our community. At a time when we should be raising more money to help defeat gun violence, address public health challenges, take on climate change, defeat prejudice, and improve our nation's mental health, instead, we are forced to look inward and play defense against hate. Thank you again to Representatives LaShawn Ford and Fran Hurley for inviting me to participate. Thank you to the task force members, and thank you to all the speakers and the organizations and communities they represent for so forcefully and eloquently speaking about the challenges they are facing and how we can work together to address them.
Thank you very much. And we will move right along to the Illinois Department of Human Rights. Director.
Thanks. Happy to wrap up this amazing hearing. Good morning, Co-Chairs Ford and Hurley, spokesperson Windhorst, and all the members of the task force. And I'm thrilled to be able to talk about the Illinois Commission on Discrimination and Hate Crimes and the administration's commitment to addressing bias, incident, and hate crimes in Illinois. And I'm very thankful for this hearing and thankful for the witnesses prior to me who have clearly demonstrated the crisis we face, which will allow me to take a little bit of time off of mine and focus primarily on the recommendations we're working on. In April 2021, Governor Pritzker appointed members of this commission for the first time in more than a decade. It had been about 12 years. We've worked hard to reflect the diversity of our state. The members bring years of professional expertise and personal experience representing civil rights and community-based organizations, law enforcement, state agencies, and the Attorney General's office as well. You've heard from two of our commissioners today, Julie Justice and David Goldenberg. The commission has also received dozens of hours of testimony from numerous subject matter experts, including Abby at Castle and Mike at Equality Illinois, who you've heard from today, and many others who've conducted research, engaged with residents from across the state. We know that a comprehensive strategy requires both preventive and enforcement components. On August 4th, 3 weeks ago today, the commission unanimously approved its first report of recommendations, which we've submitted to this task force. Approval of these recommendations is obviously the very first step. The commission and the administration are working now to figure out how to make these a reality, how to get them implemented, and how to make sure the commission has the infrastructure to go as long as we need to continue. Our goal is to start by addressing victim and community support, expanding law enforcement and prosecutor training, improve data collection, reporting, and analysis, and of course, to prevent the hate crimes and bias incidents before they happen. The first, and there's seven recommendations, so you get a sense as to where I'm headed. First, the commission recommends that the state establish a hate crimes and bias incident helpline. This would be separate from law enforcement. It would serve victims of hate crimes and bias incidents, but it would also empower the agencies and groups that people already turn to when they're in crisis. We've heard time and time again that when people are in a crisis, they're going to go to who they trust, and we want to arm the people that they trust. Second, establish a grant program for those community-based social service agencies to one, connect with our helpline, and to develop and deploy the resources and programs to serve the victims of hate crimes within their respective service areas. Third is educating law enforcement through a comprehensive hate crimes basic and in-service training module that would be developed for local agencies through the Illinois Law Enforcement Training Standards Board in consultation with our commission, and in collaboration with bar associations and related organizations, develop and offer a hate crimes continuing legal ed course for state's attorneys, assistant state's attorneys, public defenders, and judges. With the guidance of commission members representing law enforcement in the AG's office, we've already been able to make progress on this front. Fourth, make sure our statistics accurately tell us what's really going on by establishing a statewide data collection and analysis hub for hate crimes and bias incidents that would draw from multiple sources, including the proposed helpline I referenced, the Illinois State Police, community-based organizations that receive reports of incidents and crimes, CASEL and ADL serving as good examples of that, among many others. Fifth, as part of a broader review of the state crimes statute, using the Department of Human Rights capacity to investigate best practices and develop educational programs to discourage hate crimes for each protected class that may satisfy requirements for orders of probation or conditional discharge for offenders. One of the things we've learned is that there's requirements that judges may have in sentencing, and then the resources are not out there to provide to provide that training. So that's something that we would begin taking on and already have as well. Six, explore and engage in partnership opportunities with an academic and a research institution to develop and deploy interventions that would work to inoculate individuals from being radicalized. You've heard many comments today about the radicalization of white supremacist groups. We need to stop that radicalization before it happens. It's very hard to undo once it occurs. And there's some really good models out there that we want to join into. And finally, in consultation with state and local units of government, develop and implement a comprehensive strategic community and partner outreach plan that we would review annually, but to make sure that we're reaching the people that we need to reach, both to stop hate crimes and to educate people as to what they are, but also to report when they happen. As I noted earlier, our commission's now shifting to this implementation phase. We've begun convening a set of working groups to learn from experts about how to move forward with these recommendations. We have some ideas, but we certainly need more information as we move forward. We are committed to the open engagement with all stakeholders to ensure that everyone in Illinois feels heard and supported. I want to be clear that our goal is not to replace any existing resources, but to better coordinate and expand what exists to provide a more comprehensive and holistic approach. We know that we have a shared responsibility to work collaboratively to address the issue from all angles. And I know this feels overwhelming after we come out of some of our meetings, we all feel like we need a little bit of therapy, but I want to be sure that I say that we are not powerless against hate. There are steps we can take to move forward. And I look forward to working with all of you to help solve this very complex problem. And I'm certainly happy to answer questions as well as the commissioners and the experts that are represented here today.
Thank you, Director. Is there a number or is it 911 that people should call to report hate crimes? Do you have a number for the
department? It'd be law enforcement. It'd be their local law enforcement, so 911 is correct.
Thank you very much. That means that hate crimes are reportable to 911 because it's a criminal offense. And so if you feel that you are being threatened by hate crimes, please call 911. This will conclude our hearing. And I will say that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I hope that we can come together, regardless to our backgrounds, to condemn hate in Illinois. I see we have Representative Winhurst, minority spokesperson, has been here. And I think Representative Yetnock should be added to the role if he wasn't. And let's open it up to questions from members. I think Patrick Winhurst would like to be recognized.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was going to point out that I was present. I'm sorry I was late to the hearing. I had an issue that came up that I had to address, but the information I heard, I appreciate. One thing I would point out, with the Safety Act and the Pretrial Fairness Act, it appears to me that the offense of hate crimes is not one that is detainable pre-trial, meaning that if an individual is arrested for a hate crime, that individual will be released within 48 hours. So that is something as a legislature, we may want to examine and see if there needs to be corrections there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Winhurst, for that. And for all those Americans that fly the flag, it's un-American to institute hate on anyone. Representative Hurley, Chair Hurley, anything before we conclude our hearing?
Just want to say thank you again to everybody who presented statistics and stories and life experiences. So thank you.
All right, and that will conclude. Thank you very much. We look forward to the next hearing for this task force. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.